Welcome to the Aussie Expat Podcast. In today's episode, we launch a new series called Ask an Expert. Throughout 2019, we're going to be interviewing a number of experts who Atlas Wealth Management works with through the year, including tax, immigration, insurance, estate planning, and all the other gamut of issues that go with becoming an expat. This is a live webinar we ran with a bit of Q&A at the end, so hopefully you find a bit of value. And just a quick mention too, that we'd sincerely appreciate it if you could not only subscribe to the channel, but also give us your reviews. It's these reviews that not only help us make the channel better, but also help other Aussie expats find the channel and provide value. Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Myself and James and Glenn will hopefully bring you some value that we find there's a lot of mysteries out there regarding US tax. My name is Brett Evans. I'm the Managing Director of Atlas Wealth Management, joined tonight by James Ridley, who's also a Director of Atlas, and Glenn Hines from Australian American Tax Services. So what we want to do is run through probably 30 to 40 minutes of just the top key points that we're looking at when it comes to problems that Australian expats are facing in the US. And then from that point, what we're going to do is then throw it open to some questions. We have been emailed a number of questions. There is a chat box feature and also a question box feature. So if you do have any questions, please put them in the questions and we'll run through a bit of Q&A at the end. So gentlemen, let me just start sharing my screen here and I will kick off those questions for you.
Sounds good.
Okay, just a quick question to the audience, just to make sure everyone's okay there. Can we just get a quick nod as to whether everyone can see the presentation on the screen? Yep, okay, everyone's coming back. Fantastic. So, rightio, let me just go through, and I just want to do a quick bit of housekeeping. Like anything in this litigious world, we have to address disclaimers. So a key one for us is to make sure that you do not misinterpret any of the information that myself, James, or Glenn says is personal advice. We don't like getting sued. We've never been sued in the past, and we don't get sued in the future. So this stuff is general in nature. We were just talking about general concepts. We're not referring to any specific people. If you do have a question that is specific to your circumstances, then by all means, reach out to ourselves or Glenn. We'll put our contact details at the end of this slide. So running through, who is Atlas? We're the leading provider of Australian expat financial advice, and we've won multiple domestic and international awards, both for our work that we provide to Australian expats and also to the investment work that we provide to them as well. We're proud to work with clients in over 28 countries. A lot of those are in the United States. I think last count we had clients in about 27 states. In the United States. So we've done a fair bit of work in this space. Obviously, that's how we met Glenn. We obviously needed to find a solution to our clients' tax needs in the US, and we've been proud to work with Glenn for a number of years now. We are the global financial advisors to Australian expats. From our point of view, Australian expats are like satellites. They're always transiting the world, and you know, we have clients moving both into and out of the United States. And hopefully tonight we'll go through and run through some of those key points that our clients' pain points face. Who was Australian America Tax Services? Established in 2008, they've got over a decade of experience with a number of international tax situations, both with international retirement accounts, foreign real estate, foreign earned income, international business ventures, and obviously your single and joint filing of individual tax returns in the US. So why you need to tread carefully? Well, that's what we're going to run through tonight. The biggest thing for us is, you know, in years gone by, there was a bit of apathy towards your tax lodgements. In today's digital world, there are no take no prisoners. We all know how tough the IRS can get. And the biggest thing for us is we want to make sure that you're fully informed so you never have to get that phone call from the regulators. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm now going to throw it open to James and Glenn and run through some of these top 10 problems.
Sounds great, Brett. Thanks for that. So moving forward, first point that we want to address is international agreements. So what does the IRS have to do with my business in Australia, Glenn?
What does the IRS have to do with your business in Australia? It has to do with everything. If you are a US citizen, a green card holder, or a US resident, and even some other situations, and you're any one of those, everything that you do worldwide is their business.
So everything gets captured, worldwide income, all those sort of things they want to know about.
I mean, that's generally, yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I suppose, what is FATCA? So the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, what is that?
Oh, the ability of America to reach out and touch everyone in the world. I can't remember exactly, 130 countries it's got an agreement with. All the world's global economy runs through America, and this is a way that America can keep its fingers in everything.
Yep. Is America signed up for FATCA as well? Are they tied to FATCA, or is that common reporting standards where they're not actually signed up to it, but they're the one that want everyone obviously abiding by it?
I don't know. I have to give Donald a call and ask him.
Actually, I can jump in there. I can confirm that US has not signed up to the common reporting standard.
Well, there's over 100
countries and territories. The funny thing is, it's a great case of US saying, do what I say, not what I do. So they encourage everyone to sign up to the CRS, and in actual fact, they don't have to abide. So there's no obligation for them to pass any information back to foreign governments. They can do it on an as-need basis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving forward.
There you go.
Is there a current double taxation agreement between Australia and the US?
There absolutely is, and that's been around for, what, since 1982, I think they signed that?
Yep. 83.
83, yep. Sorry.
And I suppose with it being so old. No, you go, Glenn, just with it being so
old.
You're
right, I'll finish your sentence. With it being so old, it comes with its problems in the fact that it hasn't kept up to date with changes as recently, you know, one of the biggest criticisms that it's never dealt with superannuation, which came about 84, Brett.
Yep, correct.
Yeah, I got one right.
No, exactly right. It is so old and everything's changed since then, and as the governments keep moving the goalposts with regards to legislation changes, the DTAs don't change at all, so it's left for everyone else to try and interpret and understand.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get on that later, but I mean, like, the British sat down and got theirs fixed up in 2012. Australia government is letting down Australian citizens in a big way by not sorting this one out.
Mm, yeah, exactly right. All right, well, moving forward, Brett, I'll let you change over that slide.
Yep, there we go. Pre-departure.
Yep. So pre-departure advice. So, Glenn, you know, what can Australians heading over to the US do before they leave?
Seek advice with people that know what they're talking about would be the biggest thing. I see time and time and time again these good-natured Australian accountants, lawyers, and people setting their clients up within the laws of Australia, doing the best they can, and it's a bit much to ask in many cases Australian accountants or Australian professionals to know every ins and outs of the US legislation. But one thing, you know, I always say that a podiatrist is a physician, but you wouldn't go to see one for a brain injury. But also a podiatrist would know if a brain injury came in, not to try to treat it. And that's important, I think, to make sure that when you're asking, shopping around for advice, getting your advice, that it's hard to, what questions do I ask to know that they know what they're talking about? Well, they're doing your homework before you go, and if they're not asking certain questions, that would be a trigger to maybe prod them a little bit further. Have you done many of these before? Have you? How many clients you got that have left Australia and gone to America? And if that's not lots, you probably need to look for some of those.
Yep. No, of course. And, I mean, a straightforward question, this next one, you know, is there a good or bad time to become a US resident?
There is. I mean, it depends on what's going on in your life. Are you about to inherit money? Are you about to sell property? Are you about to all the many, many different things? And try to get everything done before you come to America, and then keep hold on to it until you leave.
Yep.
Okay. Quick question for you, Glenn. There too. You know, obviously coming in the early part or the later part of the year, you know, do you want to run through some of the scenarios there?
That's a good point. Yeah, so the one that really catches people up is this substantial presence test. So the substantial presence test is a 183-day number. Now, that 183-day comes about from the 100% of the days that you're dealing in that tax year, a third of the days of the year before, and a sixth of the days the year before that. And these days, it doesn't matter if you're there walking around in a bikini on Waikiki Beach or you pulled in on a cruise ship in Fort Lauderdale for a couple of days, those days count. So if you add up all those days and you get to that 183, you have met the substantial presence test for that year for the United States. Now, then when does your residency begin, though? So if you happen to step foot, you know, in America and you've got that 183 days, that first day that you're in the United States in that year, that determines your residency. Now, if there's a 10-day clause, if you've got a closer connection to another country, you can submit something and get that out, those days out. So I've a couple of just recently where people have come to America for like 14 days. We can exempt 10. That leaves 4 back in February. Then they don't arrive again until later in the year. But then there's also the clause about the 183 days in that year. If you haven't been in America in that year for 183 days, this is on top after you've once you have met the substantial presence test, you still can be a non-resident if you use a straight oath, does have a treaty, if you fill out a form and claim a closer connection to another country. So remember, as a non-resident, you're only required to tell them information that regards to what's US-sourced income. There is another. There's another few little bits and pieces, but timing is absolutely everything. And even coming over for that interview can affect you dramatically.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's also important. We do have a number of people on here who are in Australia looking to move to the United States, and I think it's important to point out too, the tax year in the US is completely different to Australia.
Right. Yeah, January through December. So that's something versus the June, July, and that causes lots of complications of calculations when it comes to various parts of when you are a resident and when you cease being a resident of Australia. And remember, there's part-year residencies as well. A lot of the times I see people keeping that Australian residency and paying Medicare levy needlessly. And they
And I think also too, you know, with the Australian advice landscape gone, what we're going through with Royal Commissions, and we've seen a lot of the dirty laundry laundered for the public to see. You know, there has been a push in the past by Australian accountants and financial planners to set up SMSFs, family trusts, and all those sort of things.
Right.
You know, I think this is from a pre-departure point of view one of the most important considerations, because just because it's great in Melbourne, Sydney or Brisbane doesn't mean it's great in San Francisco, Boise, Idaho or New York.
I think one of the classic lines from a client in California was after his accountant had set up his little sole proprietary business as a trust, and then he runs it and his parting comment to, why did I do this? It has ended up costing me more money paying you and the other bloke in Australia than I was going to save, and all this was just to circumvent paying himself mandatory super contributions.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yep. Okay. And I suppose, I'll briefly touch base on the last question, you know, can I obtain advice from any Australian financial planner or accountant on moving to the US? I mean, you briefly touched that in the beginning, Glenn, about, you know, asking them those questions. Do they currently have US clients? You know, what are maybe some of their US client situations, just so you're sort of almost vetting them a little bit that they have that relevant experience.
Yeah, I had a client yesterday call me up, and one of her comments was, I'm not, she's an attorney, she said, I'm not willing to pay someone to learn how to do this. Mm. And, I mean, that's an ethics thing of that individual to say, hey, I don't know what I'm doing with this, you need to go seek advice elsewhere. But you've got to ask, because the one point I was thinking about making this afternoon to you guys is, once you get into this and you think everything's fine and you're a couple of years down the track, when you work out that it's not fine, there's some key timing issues there that can cost you very, very, very a lot of money if to undo what has been done. And, you know, they always say, you know, that why am I preparing these taxes with the information you give me? Well, in the end, it goes on the client. The client's the one signing under the penalty of perjury that everything's true and accurate to the best of their belief. And the tax preparer's name's on there just saying that they prepared it with the information that was given. So, but how well if I don't even know to ask the question, and so that's where we end up finding out a lot of problems.
Okay, yep. So it's moving forward and obviously moving on to failing to seek advice. So don't wait until tax time to seek advice, obviously getting it at the appropriate time, as you just said, you know, engaging the right type of accountants, engaging the right type of financial planners that are going to be able to help you get everything sorted before tax time. And I like this one, last one. Do not act on advice that is provided in Facebook groups. So, Glenn, I know you're not an advocate, but tell us more about the Facebook groups and what you've seen in the past.
I've always been fascinated, absolutely fascinated, that people will ask a question of complete strangers based upon that they share the same passport, and then valid and think that that's right advice. How many times I've seen people ask questions that they could easily go to the U.S. Immigration Department and look, and there's the answer. That's not the place. General, sure, where can I get, do this or do that? But remember, you've got to seek it for professional, not Facebook people. Some of the stuff we see come across those Facebook groups is not just wrong, it's downright scary. And if you followed it, you're setting yourself up potentially for some major falls later on.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly.
People
right.
are well-meaning, that's true. People are well-meaning, but it's not necessarily the best place to get advice that can cost you so much money.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think we've all seen the very long, big threads that go in those groups, and obviously the information that is being shared it's very personalised and very scary, and people just accepting that, you know, saying, yep, that's right, I'll go and do that through, you know, moving on to one of those DIY tax returns. Obviously, they'll use the advice they're given in those Facebook groups, and then they might go and do so using, you know, these online tax lodgement services, as you put down here. So TurboTax. So what is TurboTax as an example?
It's a calculator. That's what TurboTax is. It's a TurboTax is great in certain situations. If you're the single person, even if married, and you've got that one job with that one piece of paper, you've got no bank accounts in the world, you've got none, and that's all you've got, great, absolutely fantastic. You've got OCR software, take a picture of the form, bang, it fills it all in for you, no problem at all. But it's only as good as the numbers that you put in. Crap data in, crap data out, and that's absolutely the case. It will not prompt you. Not just picking on that one product, but those sort of things will not prompt you to do certain things. Again, if you don't know to ask the question, well, TurboTax didn't ask me, so therefore my tax return's correct. Just because the tax return gets accepted doesn't mean it's correct. Yes. I mean, that's an important thing to remember. People have this quite confidence that once it gets accepted, oh, I'm good to go.
So I've really
It's a great one about Donald Rumsfeld, is it? The known knowns, the known unknowns, the unknown unknowns. You know, TurboTax doesn't tell you about the unknowns.
Yeah, I've not that one again. I'm not sure, but I think, you know, one of the particular forms that it affects expats is the Part 3 of the Schedule B, which asks you if you're a signatory authority over any foreign accounts. If you don't have any, the other thing that's above that is the interest and the dividends. If you don't have any interest in dividends to report, I haven't played with that side of the consumer side for a while, that it doesn't prompt you to ask you that question. So therefore, you never get asked, do you have signatory accounts? And then it says, are you required to meet, have you met the FBAR requirements? That doesn't even, I'm not 100% sure, but I've heard that that doesn't get, question even gets prompted if you don't have any interest or dividends.
Yeah.
So it becomes a non-disclosure.
Yeah.
Yep. And then no one's really to blame except for yourself because no advice has been sought.
It's a catch on you. And in the end, it's you that has to face the consequences of it down the track.
Yeah, and I suppose that quote – sorry, Brett, you go, mate.
No, that's right. Go ahead, James.
Oh, no, I was just going to reference that quote that's down the bottom, which is just too true here. I mean, what is good is seldom cheap, and what is cheap is seldom good. It's obviously
That's from the Lloyd's Fish Bar at Watulla in Queensland back in the mid-'80s.
Yep.
And, Glenn, obviously, you know, you would meet a number of people who, you know, move to the United States. They're not sure what to do. They talk to a colleague in a business who more than likely is a U.S. citizen, and they use TurboTax or they do some sort of self-lodgement. You know, for the people that you meet after that, you know, that have gone through and realise they've done the wrong thing, you know, is there some sort of commonality? Is it just, you know, lack of education, or is it, you know, people, you know, going from the Australian system that they understand to a foreign system they think, oh, well, you know, tax is tax and, you know, we just sort of follow suit?
I think you know, generally that most people want to do the right thing, and they, and most people understand that it's a completely different, you know, we all speak the same language over here, and all the same, but we don't speak the same language. And that goes with government, it goes with schooling, it goes with shopping centres, it goes with driving on the other side of the road, for instance. Nothing is the same, and understanding that is important. But when people, and when you first get over here, you haven't got a lot of money, and tax preparation overall, you hear, is a lot more expensive than it is in Australia. It just is. And then when you and everything's based upon time, the more effort that's put into the return, it's going to cost you more money. You spend more time sitting with a lawyer, it's going to cost you more money. And so people are like maybe a bit gun shy, ring around, find out, you know, and then they find out, oh, go, like what you said, Brett, go see this bloke down at the shopping mall. He'll sort you out for only $250. And he does. But yeah, you finally, something happens a couple of years later and you're like, crap, now that $250 now is going to cost you $1,000 or more to fix. Mm.
And that's where they get a question about, you come from Brisbane, Austria. You know, what's it like? What's your skiing like? You know, they wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah. Why would an American even think to ask a question about, do you have foreign bank accounts? They're American. They don't have foreign bank accounts.
Mm. Yeah, no, exactly right. Just a quick housekeeping one. There's a couple of people putting their hands up. Guys, what we're going to try and do is, so we can get through this, chuck your questions in the questions field. Just so we can go through and address those as well too. So it's just a lot easier to address the questions. Otherwise, we could be here all night. So,
mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So moving forward onto, I suppose, number five, common landmines. So, Glenn, you briefly touched base on, you know, a trust before, and obviously ABN being an Australian business number, an Australian company number in Australia. So why are these type of things that you might maintain when you go over to US landmines?
For reporting, one of the things that the American tax stuff has got is these information returns. They're not so much about taxing you, some of them are. It's so much about information. But the thing about these information returns that follows them are the massive penalties that follow them. A lot of the information returns are $10,000 penalties for failure to file or incomplete file. If they deem that you haven't filled it out good enough, they can penalize you on that. Some, there's one particular one that's $25,000. And these are just information. One very easy one that has a $10,000 penalty, you inherit over $100,000 American dollars. All you've got to fill out is dead set. It's about five lines. That's all that's required. You're not going to be taxed on that money generally. You're not going to be taxed on that money, but you don't fill out the form, $10,000. That's
penalty.
And there's more to it than that. One of the forms has $10,000 or 5% of what you didn't tell us about.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Different forms have different the way they structure. But international stuff is juicy in the fact that they can increase some of the penalties with regards to that. ABNs and ACNs. If you have you used to mow lawns and the bloke wouldn't give you any money until he had an ABN and you just forgot about it. Guess what? Even if it's doing nothing, there's a thing called dormant, and there's dormant corporation, dormant foreign disregarded entity. You still have to fill in the form and say that it didn't do anything. And if you don't fill in the form, there's the penalty can apply again. So these tiny little things can be so costly. Trusts are the big ones. I mean, that's massive. Australians love setting up trusts and putting things in with shelf companies holding this. All of that has multiple reporting requirements under the US system.
Yeah, and then I suppose leaving into the bottom line, passive foreign investment companies, these type of items usually get, obviously, Aussies that head over in trouble.
Oh, this is the bunt. This is the one that I hold my breath when I give them the price, because it's a lot of work. They're a lot of work. Some of the most, it's the most bizarre math that's ever come up. Yanni, you got to Google foreign mutual funds PFIC and look at the articles, and all the articles end up with the same conclusion. It's ridiculously silly math, punitive taxation treatment. Foreigners should avoid them at all. Americans should avoid them at all costs. And you only end up spending money to your tax preparer. That's the moral of it all. But Australians, one of the shocking things that happened last year was when BlackRock changed the domicile of 18 of those ETFs, all these good Aussies doing the right thing. Well, they've helped everyone in Australia. They messed all my people up here.
Yeah, we actually got an email from BlackRock saying, good news, big announcement. And I think we were pretty much 1% of the world, the Australian market, that, you know, James and I almost shed a tear when that email came out. So
to explain to everyone, that means the ETF is a group of funds, and they are all, each one of them's got a different domicile. And if that domicile is not the United States, then that's subjected to that punitive tax treatment.
Yeah, exactly. And that's right.
Just to run through the quick, you know, the classification, what a PFIC is for everyone. So for those out there, it's anything that's passive in nature, that's not an operating business, that derives 75% of its revenue from passive income, or 50% of the assets are passive. So obviously an ANZ, a BHP, a Telstra, they're operating businesses, as opposed to a iShares or a Vanguard, or I'm going to show my age here, Argo Investments, the Djerriwa, all the old listed investment companies that people have favoured in the past. You know, they're not in the business of making widgets. They're just investing money to get a passive return from it. So, you know, we've seen, you know, over the last 20 years, a massive ramp up in people trying to do the right thing by investing and putting money away, but they don't realise that that, you know, Vanguard or iShares investment in that ETF or beta shares, you know, 5 years ago, can come and bite them in the backside.
And what the one that's the real painful one is the self-managed super. That self-managed super that holds PFIX, big money.
That's a double one, isn't it?
That's
a double one. PFIC, and then you've got the investments inside the SMSF as a PFIC.
Yep. Exactly right. And it's quite common, I suppose. Yeah, I've seen a lot of cases where individuals, they're heading overseas, they've engaged financial planners or accountants, and, you know, the financial planners haven't actually taken into account that they're heading over to the US, so they'll treat them as a normal Australian financial, you know, Australian resident. So they'll go ahead and put them in these range of managed funds, you know, in between 5 to 15, depending on their portfolio, and then they'll send them over there, and then, you know, 18 months later, they'll, you know, they might reach out to that financial planner saying, listen, I can't hold these anymore. My account just told me what these are, PFICs, what do I do? And it can also sometimes be the case where that Australian financial planner doesn't actually know what that even is, so they don't know what to do.
Good news on PFIX I'll throw out there. It was a year or so ago. There's some. If you're a dual status resident, where you're a non-resident for part of the year and a resident for the other part, as long as you have a timely filed return, you file on time, and that you are from a treaty country, which Australia is, you can, another couple of parameters there, but you can request that during that year of dual status year, you can be exempt from, you still got to declare all the income, but the actual payment. And then there's the $25,000 or $50,000 for a couple, de minimis rule. So at the end of the year, if all your PFIX are not valued at that, then you can get around not filing the
form. Would you say, based on that, that's almost a bit of a grace period for that individual, that couple, to go and clean that mess up for the
but by the time that happens, it's already this year, and they're already on the hook for January through to whenever they work that out.
Yeah, of course. So seek tax advice even before.
Remember the PFIX, even if you do something with them, there's one part of the legislation there that it maintains that passive, that the old saying, what's once a PFIX, always a PFIX.
Yeah, I know the amount of work that James and I've had to go through to change all our clients' accounts. Now we're trading US traded securities that are US domiciled as opposed to Australian traded securities that used to be US domiciled. You know, I think right now, James, correct me if I'm wrong, I think last memory there's only about 8 now in Australia that are still US domiciled ETFs, and everything is pretty much Australian domiciled now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually a little bit less than that now. I know there's not too many managers that do it, and it's mainly because they don't want to have to do anything or have anything to do with doing the required reporting requirements with the IRS, to be honest. It's just more tax work for them. So that's why they've changed all their domiciles in the past.
Yeah, that's right. They're sort of hiding under the guise of, you know, not wanting to do W8BEN forms, but in actual fact, you know, from their point of view, you know, they're appealing to the Australian resident as opposed to the international resident.
Yeah. Exactly right.
Okay, so moving along to the next one here. Now, this is probably the biggest one. Glenn, talk about Australian Super.
Yeah. Who knows what the answer is, really, isn't it? The treaty's never dealt with it. That's unfortunate. That's never happened. Hopefully that happened. There's a group of people out there fighting hard hard, yeah. really hard to make that happen. And hopefully they can be successful and they can sit down with that. So without having it in the treaty and without having any court cases that have got any sort of precedence to it, all we're left with is a lovely gentleman, a group was able to, under a FOIA request, get some internal emails and memos that were out to get an idea of how the IRS view Australian Super. And you can see when you can Google these emails, and you can see that they sort of have no idea themselves in many, yep. many ways. But they do make some, and they do make some positions of sorts yep. in those emails and stuff that you can, guidelines if you want a thing, you can see, well, that's how they view it. So it seems to be everyone has gone out and generally treated, but everyone's different. Every single person, single super situation is different. You can't brush everyone. And so yep. generally, it's been treated as those in the irregular old industry super fund where your employer has paid the mandatory 9.5% and there's the corpus in that super is more their money than yours. Most of the professionals seem to be in America are treating that under the employee trust rules where contributions and distributions are taxable income. And then, but if you look through those emails and memos, they talk about that still has to go on the FBAR and still has to be reported. Now, yep. the self-managed super fund, a little bit more black and white in the fact that that is a trust yep. and it is foreign. And then we've got the foreign grantor trust rules. That's a little bit easier path to follow, boom, boom, boom. But without Donny, the few private letter rulings they have and those internal emails and stuff and the memos, that's all we've really got to go on. So that's how pretty much the industry sort of trend. Now, you know, there's some differentiating opinions out there in the marketplace, and it's really disappointing the Australian government hasn't stepped in and done something. I just don't – maybe we haven't got the population over here to force that sort of thing. But, hey, it's only been around since 1984, so, I mean, we can't rush these things.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, James.
I was just going to move on to, is there a best practice then when it comes to handling your super and, you know, should I always be reporting it on those statements?
If you read those internal memos and emails, that's what they've said, that it still needs to go on there. But correct me if I'm wrong. The super funds in Australia, they're not required to report.
That's correct. So page 42, there's a carve out for super funds. Mm. However, we have heard of super funds still reporting anyway. So just because they don't have to, doesn't mean they're not doing it. And I think, you know, that's actually one question I was going to raise with you. It's, you know, super something that touches everyone. Everyone's got between 1 and 50, you know, super accounts. And there is obviously a lot of apathy towards it, especially if you're 20s and 30s or 40s. You know, you can't touch it for 20-odd years. People don't realise that what you're talking before about the passive foreign investment companies actually yep. comes into PFIX. You know, if you have a Australian super account or a host plus account or a rest account or any of those sort of what we call pooled super funds, you have a look at your statement. Inside there, you won't see ANZ, BHP, Telstra. You'll see Growth Trust or Balance Trust. So, and essentially, you are holding a PFISC inside of a pooled super fund. So the way it gets sort of complicated here.
Yeah, unless you want to take the view that the foreign pension funds that are set up with the intent to be something that you save for later on can be exempt from those rules. So, and this is why it's disappointing that it's never been sat down and thrashed out black and white. The Brits got to do it. You know, why haven't our government done it?
Yeah, exactly. I know there is no reason when this, you know, or depending who you talk to, between 150 and 200,000 Australian expats in the United States at any one time. So, you know, when you consider that and you consider, you know, to me, there's a lot of apathy towards expats in general from Australia. I mean, look at the current main residence exemption debate that's going on in the Senate. You know, that is, and then that's for another conversation on another webinar. But, there is massive apathy, and it's something that, you know, the US citizens are always great because they rally behind the congressmen and all those sort of things that develop that. It's something that I think, you know, we are going to have to work on at a 40,000-foot level and we'll certainly address with everyone, and you'll see us do it over the coming years to try and garner support to lobby those sort of changes, because it's not a change that is impossible to make.
No, it's not. But I do want to just touch on one other point. When I said before, you can't just black and white this super. There is no black and white. Every single is a case by case different. You could have that person with who's got that industry super fund who could then who could have more money in it, and that then we start getting to, well, is it some of is it grant or trust rules we're going to apply to it, and some of it not. And no one's exactly the same as the other is probably the best way of summing this up.
Yeah, and I suppose
I think it's great.
I always have with the superannuation, the IRS, a common question I always get on my consults is, I've been over there for either, you know, a few years. I've never reported my super. What do I do? Do I start reporting it now? Should I start, you know, report it in the beginning? You know, to those type of people that are unsure, you know, what would you say to them? Start reporting it now, or
it's never too hard. It can get hard later. I mean, You got. We're not the IRS out there, and they keep your cards pretty close to their chest on what they're going to do and how they're going to do it, and what they're looking at and what they're not looking at. And it's not for me to say if they will come after it. Mm-hmm. But I can show you the internal email and memo thing where they did specifically say that they're still to report it on there. So, if you don't report it, is it a foreign account? Yes. Is your name on it? Yes. Is it your? Well, you've met the Schedule B Part 3 requirements.
Yep.
So then if you don't put it on there, then you've exposed yourself to the same penalty if you didn't tell any other sort of account.
Yeah,
I don't know if anyone, we've heard about these three private letter rulings, but the getting into it with them, maybe there needs to be a big court case. I don't want it to be me. I thought that Western Australian politician, was it, that had American connections that was in trouble with them?
Yep.
I thought, I was hoping this is good. We've got someone up high who's going to face a bit of stick, who's got mates in that level. Maybe we can finally get a decision on it. But then again, not having a decision on it might be a good thing too, to maintain.
We saw that with Boris Johnson. You know, was it a year or so ago he sold a property in London? Turns out Boris was born in the United States. So, he's been caught in the updraft as well too. And the more we dig, you know, the more people are becoming casualties. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people I've met over the years who were born in the United States, lived there for five or six years, and then moved back to Australia.
Accidental Americans is the common term for it.
Because the US is one of the only places.
When parents think they're doing the cool, right thing by getting their kids the US citizenship or any citizenship when they're kids, why not wait till they're 18 and let them make the decision if they want that?
Yeah, because potentially you could burden them for the rest of their lives if they don't relinquish that.
Who knows where they're coming with this? The last 12 months has been very interesting in international tax and expats, tax stuff and that. A lot of different things have happened to show this focus. So only a couple of months ago, the release about the 8938 saying that only collected $500,000 in penalties, but from a good source saying that this is their new roadmap to coming up. It's low-hanging fruit. They've already got the laws passed. And all the data they've got, that who with the Freedom of Information, the 14, 15, 16, was nearly a million Australians' information was given to the IRS from the ATO in 2016. It's not a matter of if they know, it's a matter of when they get around to crunch that data. And I saw something else that they'd hired a few months ago, some huge, massive software developing firm to crunch data, to design something. When it gets to the point, though, where you write no and a data mismatch happens and all of a sudden a letter automatic pops out, that's a day it's going to be scary. And we talked about this recently, Brett. There's no bottom to this. It's not like some of the other rules that says, well, if you don't earn this much, then it doesn't matter. $10,000, $10,000. Yeah. I don't care if you earned $20,000 last year.
Hmm. And I think the biggest one about, you know, does the IRS know about my super, this is hypothesizing, but I think it's planned, you know, as the nose in your face, what's going to happen. Those who have Australian bank accounts now have to tell their bank where they are resident of if they're not resident in Australia. Mm. As soon as they say, I'm a resident of the United States, that information then gets passed the ATO, who then data shares it with the IRS as part of the FATCA agreement. So does it mean potentially down the track that the IRS could go on a bit of an exploratory mission Glenn Hines is in Indiana. He's got a Commonwealth Bank account. He now pops up on my radar as having $5 in an Australian bank account. Then they go, wait a minute, more than likely you have super. All the other things start off we go from there.
Well, not just that. I've had clients filter through over the years who have got themselves in trouble in other areas. And then all of a sudden the IRS is in their trouble, into them. They couldn't get them on this. I mean, Al Capone, that's what he went away for. I mean, one of the most interesting and funny things and nerdy things to do is to read every year the IRS's court cases and what happens. And one of the ones there where the woman stole all this money, and then when they didn't press charges, the IRS got her for not declaring it.
Yep.
The drug dealer, that he got off the drug charges, but the IRS will get him for that. There's one woman was in a little bit of immigration problem, and the IRS all of a sudden were in her back pocket.
Yeah, yep. It's that mail fraud, isn't it? They love their mail fraud too.
Easy, low hanging fruit.
I'll bring us back now on point. I think we've gone on a bit of a tangent.
Go offside.
All right, let's talk about loans in Australia now. I've only recently come across this, but Glenn, can you shed some light on what is loan rebasing?
So the thing is, one of the things that was a lot of articles were popping up a couple of years ago when the Brexit thing happened.
Yes.
And so you can find a lot of articles written from a British perspective. And they're talking about, with this global economy, people moving in and out of the country and stuff like that. With the dollar dropping, I use this example as a real simple one.
Yeah.
Is that when the Australian dollar was par back in, 2012 or something like that, and you borrowed $100,000 Australian dollars back then, and then you pay that $100,000, that would cost you $100,000 American. And you pay that $100,000 Australian back today, it's only going to cost you $70,000 American. Mm-hmm. Under this part of the tax code, they say that $30,000 interest now is gain to you, and that becomes income to you. And that's scary. And so this big push the last 12 months with the Australian dollar dropping and with the July 1st capital gain rule change in Australia, offload properties, pay off mortgages.
Yeah, okay.
Any time a US person is an obliger of foreign debt, then they get a little bit more to it than that, but that's basically how it comes into it. And it's as low as $200. $200, there was 1986 was this gap with the section 988 of the tax code, if you really want to get into it. But they did some – there's parts that will apply the pre-86 part and the post-86 part. But it's interesting to see how to be completely honest, I think you'd have to – I mean, it's not for me to say you should or should not do it. There's people out there that will say that it meets the – some things meet the overburdensome reporting – requirements. Some people will say that, but if you just want to read it to the nth degree, that's why they created the $200 thing, because they realized that every time any American overseas that bought a coffee then on a credit card and paid it off a month later, that was creating an FX calculation that had to happen. So they changed and then brought a $200 limit in and a couple of other things that exempt you as well. But it can have monstrous effects. One of my clients is about to get some bad news tomorrow about this.
In
the range of $27,000 that's going on their tax return. So if you're out there, I'll call you tomorrow.
Is it just on the transaction alone in terms of paying off the loan, or is it on the year-to-year repayments?
Yeah, it's the cessation of that. It's a few different things, but to keep it real simple, when you're getting rid of that debt. So when you sell that place, and that check for X amount of Australian dollars is cut to pay off the rest of that mortgage, then we get into the situation of did you make a foreign currency gain on that? Or, well, I didn't use American dollars to pay it off. You're a US person who has a foreign debt, and it's now there's a reason to count. Now there's a situation you need to count.
How does it affect someone doing a refinance? So
that's good, Brett. That's what the Brexit article is about. So where before you leave, if you're going and you've had a place for years, and a lot of people think they'll come over here and they'll with all the good intentions of what they're going to do, and life just doesn't work like that all the time. Where they'll never sell this place, and all of a sudden something happens, they've got to sell it, That's the quickest money they can get their hands on. So they do. The best thing you can do is refinance before you go. Again, entering that US tax system, because that then brings up the currency rate closer to what it is when you go versus 2012 when we're talking a 40 split, percent split.
What about someone who's overseas already? They've been in the US for 2, 3, 4 years and decides they want to find a different mortgage provider in Australia on their Australian property. If they were to refinance while they're in the US on an existing Australian mortgage, essentially that is clearing a loan, isn't it?
It is. That's exactly what will happen there. Now,
and I suppose.
The good old question is, how would they ever find out? And that's the answer to everything. If that's not the question to ask yourself, it's not for me to say one way or the other if you should or you shouldn't do it. But if it comes across my desk, you're going to do it. And if you don't, you go elsewhere. They're going to have to be looking at you pretty carefully to work this out. But any of these big payments, you're talking about banks there, Brett. If you're getting rid of mortgages, that's another bit of data that could easily cross their path. In that. Now, your monthly mortgage fee, where it's part of its principal, part of its interest, lots of people believe that falls into the burdensome category. Who burdens the category? But a lot of the time I notice, I've done it just for interest, it doesn't ever reach the two, it doesn't even reach the amount to worry about.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, the last point is on the student debt. So obviously we have that HEX and HELP system back home. I mean, if I'm paying off my HEX debt, I'm assuming that obviously gets included.
Right, and so I've gone around with a couple of people on this, people a lot smarter than me on it, and they've all told me yes. They've all told me that it's a debt, it's a loan, it's a debt that you've had, that you're a US person with a debt, and you're relieving yourself of that debt. That does not sit right with me at all, that one.
Yeah.
That does not sit right with me at all.
Yep, okay. Well, I'm moving on to the next point, number 8. So the 8-year rule. So what is the 8-year rule?
You're referring there to the long-term resident?
Yes.
Is that what you're referring to? Part of the green card. So the expatriate tax form 8854 is the form that is filled out when you are a US citizen or a green card holder who has had that green card and has been in the United States for you've had it for 8 of the previous 15 years. Yep. And when you've got that, you've then citizens you're on the hook. When you've got that green card for 8 of the previous 15 years prior to your expatriation, which is the year that you give up your card, where it's signed by the consulate or wherever whoever's signed that stamp there, I can't remember the immigration form number, then you are considered what's called a long-term resident, LTR. And then you move down a different line of calculations to see if you are what's called a covered expatriate. And that has 3 requirements. One is that you have an average tax, the amount of tax, what was owed on, this is where people get caught up thinking it's adjusted gross income. It's not. It's the amount of tax that was assessed against your income over the previous 5 years. And there moves what the average is there. That's number one, if you meet that. Number two, if you've got $2 million of net wealth. And if you look at Form 8854, it lists all the different things that how you calculate that net worth. And then number 3, this is a real cool one, you don't fill out the form. They consider you a covered expatriate if you don't fill out the form and you're required to. And then they're on you for 10 years. You fall into this other category. So if you are unlucky enough to become one of those people and that happens, what they do is, they say that they deem a sale of your assets on day before of expatriation. So let's say you have a house worth $1 million in Sydney, I've never actually met anyone that's had to go through this yet, and I hope I don't, because to hit one of that the average taxable income, you've got to be on about $550,000 a year to be in that. So anyone that's not on that sort of money or doesn't have $2 million of net worth, this isn't going to touch you. But you remember, you might still have to fill out the form. So the so they'll deem the sale. So you're not really selling this place in Sydney, and they say you do, and then there's your capital gain bill, yet you haven't sold it at all. It's just a phantom sale. Very powerful.
Let me throw a scenario at you. You know, you've got a $1 million property in Sydney, which isn't hard these days. That's almost what the average property price is in Sydney. You got $500,000 in super, and then you've got, say, a house in United States, 401k, and investment account with 100 grand in it. Would that sort of person, like, what is included or not included?
Do you have a mortgage? Do you have a mortgage on your house? Okay, well, that's going to balance out your net worth, so you might not, that's not going to, unless you're on a $550,000 a year salary, then you wouldn't fall into that category.
Okay, no, that's good. I just want to make sure, clarify for the audience, you know, that it's not on the gross
or anything. Most people aren't going to, if you're not on $550,000-ish a year, this isn't going to touch you. And so I've got a few clients that are up in and around that range. Remember, it's an average over a period of time, and different years could pop you up into it as well. And the form 8854, take a look at it if you're worried about it, and it might can calm you down because it's pretty self-explanatory what it wants you to how you balance that out. But the $2 million net worth, that could easily happen real quick if all of a sudden you inherit a whole heap of stuff. I know I've got a couple of under 25-year-old clients with nearly that in inherited assets.
With the you mentioned it's only for green card holders and citizens. So people that are on, you know, the rolling L1s or the rolling E3s that are there for that long, they're okay.
Yeah, specifically for permanent residents, legal permanent residents in the United States, and that clock starts ticking as they've been legal permanent resident in the United States for 8 of the previous 15 years prior to that year of expatriation.
Okay, no, that's good. That's clear. Okay, moving forward onto number 9. So you've briefly just touched base on inheritance, which I think is a great one because obviously there's many people over there. How is an inheritance treated by the IRS? And I know you can go down two avenues. So I might give you an example first. So if I'm a US tax resident and I receive an inheritance, a large inheritance, from someone that's never been a US tax resident, how is that taxed by the IRS?
It'll be reported. If it's more than $100,000 American dollars, you'll report it on Form 3520. That's absolutely key. You'll report it. You'll also, obviously, it'll end up in some way in your name, in your account. Your basis in it will begin on the date of death of the person, and then you'll obviously have to report it as part of your reporting requirements of your bank accounts, et cetera, and your foreign assets.
So obviously, you know, I inherited, say, $100,000 worth of shares. They're receiving dividends. Obviously, the balance doesn't get taxed, but obviously the dividend income, that's going to go inside my worldwide income, so that would be taxed, clearly.
Right, and your basis in it will begin in the date of the death of the person. So if they've had that one Coca-Cola share since 1930 that's now worth, you know, $3.2 million, you get it, you know, yours is only going to be the date that great-aunt Lola died.
Okay. Yeah, and I suppose, you know, other scenario, if I'm inheriting something from a US tax resident, how is that going to be taxed? And is there a threshold in terms of, minimum amount that it'll be taxed at, or, you know, getting over a threshold, then it'll be taxed?
Yeah, I can't remember, pull the top of the figures off the top of my head exactly what it is, but it's a lot more generous, and it's not such a low reporting requirement as the foreign stuff.
Yeah, okay. No, that's fair enough. And, I mean, inheriting a type of asset, is there other, I mean, you've just mentioned that shares get rebased. They technically, it sounds like it's a deemed disposal where the cost base gets reset, which is sounds beneficial, to be honest. What about
wish
property
they
and
that
cash?
For other stuff.
Yeah. What about property and cash?
Well, cash is the same. All that's going to happen with cash, you'll report it. 3520 if it's over 100,000 American, and then you'll put it on your FBAR account and your 8938.
Yep, and property?
Property, again, usually, correct, I'm dealing with that with a client who inherited three houses at once, trying to find out what the assessed value was during the transfer from the estate to her. So, again, if she had this, you know, housing commission house in up on North, up, you know, Vaucluse or something, it's going to be worth a hell of a lot, was a hell of a lot more money than when Grandma got it in 1932. They're not going to, their basis in it as a game is going to be at the date of when they got it.
Yep. Okay. No, that's fair enough. Okay, so moving on to number 10, US citizenship. So how does my tax status change if I become a US citizen going forward?
Oh, you could slash green card holder on this, that one.
Yep.
Yeah, slash green card. So US is one of a few countries that practice the worldwide taxation of its citizens and permanent residents, where while you're an Australian resident for tax purposes, you've got to tell worldwide income. But when you're not, unless you've got a hex debt, you don't have to tell them about what your worldwide income is. And that's been working out well. I haven't filed tax in Australia for a long time. I don't have a hex debt, though, ATO, so there. And so with these green card holders and citizens, you're on the hook worldwide. And the green card holders is a special little thing. When you leave, and because that card can be cancelled if you stay away too long, and also it can be cancelled if you try to play the "I'll claim a closer connection to another country." Mm-hmm. I mean, you're telling the United States that you're a permanent resident of the United States, and here you are claiming a closer connection to a foreign country. They warn about that. It follows you, and the thing with citizenship, if you get to vote, you get to have a federal job, you get to be an officer in the military. And you get to have a security clearance. So there is some reasons why you'd step up to the citizen role, but the other thing that if you step up, you're automatically in that consideration of that covered expatriate calculation too, where the green card holder, you've got to hit that 8-year mark.
Yeah,
it's probably one of those common questions in Facebook groups, isn't it? You know, people, they've been on an E3 for so long, and they go, okay, rightio, my employer's trying to push me across to a green card. And then they'll post the question on a Facebook group, and everyone go, yeah, go for it. It's fantastic. You can bounce between two countries. But, suddenly, you know, as you highlighted, Glenn, you jump on to the covered expatriate issue as well as having to report all of your assets back in Australia if you move back, and there's a great Facebook group that I'll do a shout out to Karen Alpert, called Fix the Tax Treaty.
Yeah.
And
good luck,
that
Karen.
group alone in Australia is also Australian expats who've returned, as well as US expats living in Australia. And if you want to consider US citizenship or holding a green card, I encourage you, I implore you to go join this group and follow the conversations, because these are the issues that you will have to deal with if you move back to Australia.
Right. Well, the other thing too about if you take on citizenship and then want to give that up, don't quote me. I think the fee for it's free to give up your green card. There's no fee.
Yep.
But I think it's like nearly $3,000 now.
To
give up your citizenship. So there's another reason why you might want to have another think about it.
Definitely.
But I mean, it's good using the global traveler on the American passport, though.
All right,
guys. Well, there's a lot of questions to get through. So let me just quickly run through some of the ones that were emailed in earlier. And what I'll do is I'll start reading those off, and we'll have a bit of a question. This one came through Ash. He'd like to understand how the US treats a lump sum insurance payout. So I'll talk in general references. I can't refer to Ash particularly here. He got diagnosed with cancer, lodged a claim on his insurance back in Australia. The claim was approved. How does he declare that on his FBAR? And does the US consider a lump sum payout as income, or therefore tax against the insurance payout?
One of the articles of the tax treaty deals with that. I'd have to have it in front of me to refer to it again, but it does deal with payments of disability and from sickness or from especially from a work-related thing. But once it hits your bank account, you're going to have to declare it on your FBAR. So.
Yep. Okay. No, thanks very much for that. Another question here from Lee. If you had an income in Australia, say renting a property out, annual leave, long service, and those sort of things, in the same financial year he worked in America, does he have to lodge the income earned in the US with the income he's earned in Australia? And I'll let the answer that one first.
Give me the parameters again, sorry.
So he had income he earned in Australia from, say, you know, renting out a property, annual leave and long service leave. So obviously he got paid out in Australia.
Yep. Oh, okay.
And
yep,
in the
yep,
same
yep,
financial yep, yep. year, worked in the US. So let's say, for example, 2018. So
US, sounds like a US tax resident to me.
Correct, yes.
Worldwide, yep. Worldwide income.
Yep. And how does that come back to that 183-day rule? You know, obviously, he's been working in the US, he got paid out, sorry, working in Australia, got paid out, had the rental income, you know, yeah, obviously.
I see that a lot with people quitting their jobs in Australia and coming over. If you can get that lump sum payout before you hit US residency, that is the way to, that is what you want.
Okay, perfect. And if he obtains a green card in the US, what are the tax rules? Okay, we pretty much covered that, you know.
I will cover that a little bit. So the green card holder, when you get that green card, where before I was talking about that first day in the United States is yet you begin your day of residence, with the green card, it's the first day you activate that green card. So these people that win the green card and then run it, fly over to America to activate it, and then yep. leave and don't come back for 8 months, you're on the hook from that day.
Wow. Because I see so many of those people in the Facebook groups, all those sort of things. That's a huge thing. Because if you go and activate it and then come back a year later, suddenly that's
all that income.
I think I think you've got a year to activate. I'm not a lawyer, immigration lawyer.
So. Okay. No, thanks very much for that. Running on to the next one here. Okay, I think we've covered off those. Okay, let's get on to the questions that have come through. Wow. Okay. Nicholas has asked, is there an app like TurboTax for non-resident Australians in the US on an E3 visa to file a return?
Let's design it.
Yes.
That's the plan.
Yep, yeah. Actually, I'll just let the audience know, Glenn's got a lot of work in the background that he's, I think it's safe to say would probably revolutionise, tax for Aussie expats. So, definitely keep your ear to the ground, when Glenn, releases that, we'll certainly be talking about it. But it's going to, solve a lot of the problems you're talking about with TurboTax in that it doesn't prompt you for anything. It just relies on your disclosure. And if you don't know to disclose something, then you don't disclose it. And bingo, suddenly there's the 10 grand we talked about before.
Watch this space, Nicholas.
Yep. Okay, Gerald has a question here. I'm an Australian who is a USA tax resident. He contributed to a 401k retirement plan in the US, and he has an IRA too, and he has a super fund in Australia. What happens when he reaches retirement age? Well, I guess I'll just preface that question is depends on where you're retiring to.
Yeah, good, Gant. Yeah, spot on. Article 19 of the tax treaty that states that where you are, if it's not a non-government pension, that where you are residing has the taxation. And then the government pension is the whoever's giving you the pension. Remember, the American government can then tax anyone anytime they want.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. He also goes on to say, here he goes. I'm a USA tax resident. When can I escape the IRS if and when I move back to the USA, to Australia?
Once you can meet that non-residency requirement, so if you can leave before the middle of the year and have that 180, you don't have that 183 days this year, even if you've still met the substantial presence test from being, so if you're a full-time 1 year, 100% of the time, 100% of the time the next year, you're only going to be in America one day to meet substantial presence, but you haven't been there 183 days, so you can meet that closer connection test and file as a non-resident.
He does actually say he's a green card holder too, so if he's going to escape the IRS, it's pretty much going to be relinquishing that green card.
He'll have to do is give up that green card. You can give it up when you're leaving, I've heard, and you can walk into the consulate in Sydney and do it too, or anywhere and do it too. But then that you'll get a piece of paper that I'll need to see, or whoever does that need to see, and you work out, start filing your last return from there. And you'll just be a dual status resident in that final year.
And another question here, how do you handle dividends from Australian stocks when you are tax resident in the US, e.g. frank versus unfranked dividends?
There's no franking credits in the United States, so it's the whole lot.
Okay, so the whole lot's in. And going through here, Julie asked questions about superannuation gains. How is that treated?
Going back to that, the realised gain in the, if you're in the grantor trust group, the realised gain will impact you. the way that the industry is treating the under the industry trust area, that's not counted.
Okay, and I think, you know, an important point to point out is people don't realise the underlying tax liabilities inside what we call pooled super funds, like we referred to before about the industry funds. By virtue of the nature of being a pooled fund, it means everyone's in that sort of communist-like state of sharing the gains and the liabilities. What it means is if you are going to a fund, say, for example, you know, it's now February, you joined that fund back in January. We see a lot of these going on with Australian expats trying to do the right thing by, you know, sort of combining their super accounts and moving them to, e.g., a low-cost provider or those sort of things. But they go into these pooled funds. Now, by going into a pooled fund, if that fund manager who manages the trust of that investment bought BHP back in 1990 and decides to sell some of those shares for whatever reason, and you've only been in that one for 1 month, then guess what? You wear that liability. So, and we've seen it before in both super funds and managed funds as well too. By virtue of the pooled fund nature, you know, you are inheriting a liability for something that could go back, you know, for as long as the fund's been around.
Exactly right.
So, and that'll appear on your statement as well too. Sometimes I've seen ones, you know, clients show me, you know, some very large tax bills inside their statements. Most people just look at the underlying numbers, see if it goes up or down. But when you actually go through and look at line by line, you know, to me, it's a very important distinction to make, because you could be exposing yourself to a liability. And certainly there are other ways to treat that. But, that, you know, once again, that's for another call. Actually, Andrew here does say, for you, Glenn, TurboTax does ask you about foreign interest and dividends.
Well, foreign interest and dividends, does it ask you about the foreign bank accounts?
Yep, no, he's left, so, but, you know, we'll certainly, hopefully he comes back, because that'd be a good one to have an answer to, too.
I was saying that if you don't have interest in dividends at all, foreign or domestic, I've heard that you're not being prompted that part three of Schedule B, where it asks you, are you a signatory,
have you got a signatory
over for accounts, yeah, because it's on the same form.
Okay, another question from Julie. Do we have to pay tax on gains/investment returns when it's all concessional contributions, 100%? So it sounds like it's an employee benefits trust. Concessional contributions. So that could be a combination of both employee and employer contributions.
Right. Yeah. That would be a very, very complex and a difficult thing to go back and work out to exactly which bit was that. And remember, once you do get taxed, once that becomes taxed in the United States, when it's deemed taxed, then you've got a basis and it won't be taxed again any future time. I had a client the other day that's what's happened to him. He's had to, you know, yeah, he's going to be taxed on 100-something thousand American dollars of income. But when he pulls it out eventually, it's never going to be taxed again.
And a question here from Ryan. What would you recommend to someone who has used both TurboTax and KPMG, so obviously the bookends of tax, in the past and thinks that there may be some mistakes?
Right, yeah. You get one person telling you that's a good one. My philosophy on this, I just don't say because I told you so. I'm a big believer of I love the MYOB, mind your own business. Go out and, you know, find out yourself. But I'll point you, I'll show you where it says this. And they say this and it says this. When there's stuff with us, there's things with ambiguity and it can be used different ways. But generally the mistakes that I see, which I see quite regularly, that they're the same things over and over again. And they're usually just done by people that don't do enough international stuff. I say you can't dabble in it. Yeah, you can't be half pregnant with it. It's something you've got to be constantly on the hook with all the time to sort of get. And it doesn't mean that these people aren't smart or anything like that. It's not about intelligence or anything. It's just not doing enough of it all the time. And I see some of the big firms too offshoring some of their stuff to some other countries where they maybe pay their workers a little bit less. That's a cause for concern. But if you've got a cause for concern, I would suggest you speak to someone that specializes in nothing but international stuff and get them to have a look at it. A lot of places will do a review of previous returns for 100, 150, $100-ish bucks just for ranges, and then we'll tell you, yep, it's fine, or no, it's not, and this is why, and you need, it needs to be fixed. But some people don't really like what they, maybe some people should just not even ask because it doesn't, not the answers they like to hear.
And I'll actually also preface that with putting up on the screen here the contact details for Glenn. You know, just as a as an important point, I think I'd like to make. You know, the work that we do with Glenn, there is no exchange of money between us. Yeah, you know, we just work
I'm
with you.
I'm more than happy to take some off you, though.
we just work with you because we know you look after our clients, and I think that's an important distinction to make. Ali here has a question. My accountant put my super account down on my US tax return as a bank account. That's incorrect, right? If so, what should it be called?
There's another good debate you can have in the international tax nerd world. Is it a custodial account? Is it go in the other account? If it's on the thing, your intent to withhold information from the IRS is absolutely not accurate. If it's on there, that's good. In the end, if you read the rules with the different forms, and remember FBAR has different requirements to Form 8938 as well. If you read the different rule, you could make the argument for other, and you could make it for custodial as well, because custodial on one of the IRS things says it's basically everything that isn't a bank account. So is it on the form, and you've been told the highest balance? That's the thing I'd be more concerned with.
Focused on. Ian's got a question here. I'm a 30-year permanent resident in the US. I have a super fund in Australia that started in 1965. If I withdraw funds in Australia, is it taxed in Australia and is it taxed in the US? Well,
what sort of fund is it? Is it a government pension fund? Is it? Yeah.
You hit the nail on the head there, and I think we'd probably need more detail there. I was going to throw it open to both yourself and James to answer that, but it's like, especially with those sort of ones, the older accounts, the devil is in the detail.
Yeah. Like every single person is different, and you got to look at it differently. You're not like, that's why Facebook groups are so dangerous in many ways.
Yep. Okay, Alice has got a question here. Inheritance. My dad recently passed away in Australia, and my siblings are going to sell their house in Sydney. I'm currently a resident here in the United States. What should I know in terms of inheritance tax? Well, I think we've pretty much covered that off on early before. Obviously, there's a declaration to be made, but in terms of from a tax point of view, there's no considerations there.
Yeah, only up. Yeah, unless it starts making money after the day you get it.
Yeah, true. Good point. Well, okay, Marnie's got a question here. If I move to the US mid-November, does my 183 days start 1st of January 2019?
No. Does your 183 days start? No. Remember, every physical day that you're in the United States counts for that math. So if you move to the United States in November. Had you been in the United States any other time throughout the year? So that's when that will start. The 183 days is a calculation over a 3-year period.
Yep. Okay. Fantastic. Andrew's got a question here. If the IRS doesn't know how to treat them, can we just report it on the FBAR and that's it? I think he's probably referring to super here.
Super, yeah.
Well, isn't that the question?
Yeah. And I think
people get really caught up in is, remember, if you just, you can never over inform them. Yep. You know, they're not going to tax it if you put it on your form. You know, and oh, I don't want to tell them anything. Well, that's up to you. But you're not going to get in any trouble for putting it on. Like, I sometimes like to send them more forms than they need to because I know they're going to have to sort through them because they annoy me. So I'll annoy them back a little bit. You know, you're not going to overburden them with information. With the IRS, I think too much is good enough. So is sometimes the best policy. You know, I'm sure they love to have as much as they can. But
I think James and I have taken the same approach as well too. And I guess what we've sort of said to our clients in the past and now is, don't worry about the now, worry about in 5 years' time when the IRS does decide to get their act together. And like we've seen with the ATO right now, you know, going after expats is a hobby for the ATO. You know,
low-hanging fruit.
Exactly.
The Chinese are doing it to their clients. I mean, this yep. self-protectionist, nationalistic ideas of all these countries are doing it. New Zealand, foreigners can't own the properties there anymore. It's happening all over the world where countries are looking out and then pulling it back in.
And I think that's the biggest thing. It's, you know, what you do today will affect you in 5 years. You know, do the right thing today, and when the IRS gets their act together and has all this mammoth amount of data that they can go after you, if you've been doing the right thing for the last 5 years, then guess what? Plain sailing. But if you think you're more clever than the system...
No one's ever going to know the answer to when will they draw the line in the sand. When they get around to sorting this out, are they going to go back till 2014, or are they going to say, right, from now on? I mean, generally, you've only got to look at what they've done in other things to see how they go. And like with their best example for the national stuff most recently, I suppose, is their 8938, their foreign asset reporting form, release, press conference, whatever you want to call it, where they said, we've only collected $500,000 since 2012. Why would you come out and say something silly like that? Because that's the word. Now we're going to... You are warned.
Yep. Okay, question here from Nicole. Do I need to tell the IRS about all of my Australian bank accounts? She has four. If I only use one to transfer her OFX funds? So she's obviously using OFX to do the currency conversion.
So question one on the Schedule B is, do you have signatory authority over foreign accounts? Yes. Question two is, do you meet the requirements to file FinCEN Form 114, which is FBAR? And that is $10,000 accumulative dollars. So if we're going with the super funds are on there, if you've got one account that has 10 grand, every other account that you've got, even if it's got 1 cent, if it's got zero, you must report the highest balance of that account. If one gets you through the gate and ticks the box, all of them go in.
And it's the highest balance throughout the year, isn't it?
And the highest balance throughout the year. So if you have three accounts with nothing in them and I give you $10,000 and you put it in one, you pull it out, it's in there for 2 seconds, and I hear this one, but I only put it in there for like a minute and I transferred it. It doesn't matter. If I put it in there for one, I pull it out, put it in another one, pull it out, put it in another one. The highest balance of each one of those accounts is $10,000. But say if it's $5,000 is the example, accumulatively, you only have $5,000, but your highest balance of each account is $5,000.
Yep. So, okay. No, that's great. Tim is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek comedy. It sounds like everyone needs to go on the dole. You guys are painting all the doom and gloom. Look, I think the reason why we wanted to put this out there was, you know, these are the top 10 problems. You know, this is not the top 10 opportunities. Yeah. You know, and the three of us deal with this stuff on a daily basis and cleaning up the mess.
Tim, cleaning up the mess. Tim, just today, 3, 4, 5 different people, I had to give some shocking news to the worst one today and one of the worst I've ever heard. A woman, Australian woman years ago, doing the right thing, having the good E3 holiday in America, decided, filed the first year and then just decided, nah, stuff it, I'm not filing anymore. The last year, you said you don't know what's going to happen in the future. 4 years down the track, she marries someone, falls in love and buys a house. Well, they just sold that house and they've moved in Germany. Well, they did the seller did the right thing, the title company, and they've withheld $85,000 of her sale because she's a foreign non-US person. She needs that back, and part of the form to get that back is, are you compliant, are you up to date the last 3 years of your tax returns? And she owes them, she hasn't filed FBARs, she hasn't done this. So my immediate advice was to stop talking to me and call an attorney.
Yep. Good advice. Julie said here, you guys are doing great. There we go. Thoroughly enjoying it. Okay, who would have thought tax could be enjoyable? But, you know, I'm glad that the message is getting through, then people are sort of finding some value out of it. Dennis has a question. Is there a main residence exemption in the US for your principal place of residence?
Yes, there is. Absolutely. $250,000 for an individual, $500,000 for a married couple. You have to have lived in the property 2 of the previous 5 years prior to the sale, and that can be reduced if the reason that you had to move and break the 2 years was for one of a few different reasons, that medical reasons, military deployments, all different things. You can prorate of that. So you sell it 5 years before that. If you've lived in it 24 months out of that five-year period, $500,000 of capital gain exemption.
Okay, fantastic. Tim's got a question here regarding FX. Are you suggesting that any gains made between the US and Australia are taxable? Taxable in Australia or taxable in the US? What is the best approach with managing these gains? Oh, Tim, I'll answer the question on the Australian side. It's, you know, the issue is if you're a resident of Australia, then yes. That's a simple one. Glenn, on the US side?
Same answer. Remember, we've got the $200 limit for the US one. If there's a currency gain and you are a US resident, you are a US person, don't say rare, US person, it needs to be calculated and should be calculated. And
so if Tim is a resident in the US, then yes. If Tim is a resident in Australia, yes, but not both.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Tim can't be... If Tim is a green card holder or a citizen and he lives in Australia, he's an Australian resident.
Yep. Yeah, okay, that's a good one. Yeah, never thought of that.
Get caught out.
Okay, question here from Sandrine. Green card holder living in the US...
Sandrine, you owe me a tax return.
She's a green card holder leaving the US for more than 1 year. Will lose the green card. Will it trigger automatically the taxation side of things?
Okay. I think if you lose that card, once you lose the card, I just had a client recently that left for quite some time, and they never sent him anything and said, by the way, your card's cancelled. The next time he stepped foot in America and he was prepared for it, they said, we've cancelled your card, and that's the piece of paper that was stamped at Los Angeles Airport saying his date of expatriation was that date that he tried to re-enter the United States. But then they let him in on an ESTA. So if you leave for a year... I don't see how that's Sandrine. You call me tomorrow. That's a tax question. Why don't I understand the tax question in that?
Okay, question from Mariani. If I'm a US citizen and decide to head back to Australia for a year or so, do I still need to report worldwide income during the period I'm in Australia?
Absolutely, 1,000 gazillion percent. You've got the freedom of the light on the hill, the house on the hill. You've got to keep telling them about it. As long as, but remember, there's multiple things that are available to U.S. tax residents that exempt you. The number one thing is the foreign earned income exclusion, right? $103,000 or something.
Yep.
So that on top of the standard deduction. So if you're a married person, you've both got $103,000, and then you've got $24,000 of tax free income as well there. So but remember the big thing with the tax bill. Is the refundable now portion of the child tax credit up to $1,400. You cannot get that if you are filing a foreign earned income exclusion, the 2555. You need to get off that and get onto filing foreign tax credit, and you can do that, and you will then be eligible. I had a good couple of clients there that we've worked that one out, and they've gone back and they'll be getting $6,000 this year because they have three American children.
So you do have different options there, which is different avenues, which is great.
Yeah.
Okay, another question from here we go. Joe, if you're on a visa, do you still have to show everything on the US tax return or only if you are a permanent resident, e.g. green card citizen?
No, the US person is the terminology we need to look at. A US person is someone is a citizen, a green card holder, or someone that has met the substantial presence test. So you can meet the substantial presence test on a tourist visa.
Yep, if you're there for long enough.
Reason that you're... That you're here, it counts towards calculating that substantial presence.
Yeah. Okay. And a question here from Joe. What's the amount of paying down a loan before you get hit with a dollar exchange gain? Zero, wasn't it?
If there's a $200 gain, if you do the math and it becomes 200 American dollars, so there's 201, 201 American dollars is going on your tax return as income.
With that, just touching base on the loan rebasing, if I'm paying out a loan but I'm making a loss on the exchange, can that loss be used?
No. If it's personal, no. So if it's personal, no. If it's a rental property, then that can qualify under the qualified business rule. I'd have to look a little bit more into it, but there is ways, but under personal stuff, no.
No, okay.
And a question here from Joe. can I claim homestead in the US when I'm claiming a principal place of residence in Australia? If I do, will it affect the PPR for the time I have been classed as a homestead? Well, I'll answer the Australian side and I'll throw the US side over to you, Glenn. The whole premise behind PPR in Australia is that's your principal place of residence. As soon as you claim something else as your principal place of residence, then it's not your PPR. So that's from the Australian side. Glenn, how does it handle on the US side?
Compliance, the homestead exemption, I think you'd be probably talking about, so you get lower property taxes, which rates. That is what maybe what you're referring to. That would be a local council, your local taxing authorities rule on if that's going to fly or not. I know there's some states that you can have, because if you own the home, I own a home, but I don't live in it. I rent it out and I rent somewhere else. So there's that situation where I own a home, and yep. Sometimes they allow you to claim a homestead exemption because that's the only home you own, yet you don't live in it, and you get to claim a rental exemption. So all the local taxing authority would be the answer to that, with 50 states, and it's 50 different answers.
It's like this, isn't it? It really is. Okay, Gerald's has come back to say, TurboTax does not cover all FBAR requirements.
There you go. I don't know.
So obviously Gerald's has jumped on TurboTax, and that's the case. And then he says, for information, regardless, FBAR filing is required separately from TurboTax.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, good point. Absolutely. That came up in a group the other day too. So, yeah, the FBAR has to be filed completely separate to your tax return. The only thing that files with your tax return is the next level up of reporting, the Foreign Asset Reporting 8938. FBAR is sent completely separate. The only thing that's sent with your tax return which regards the FBAR is Schedule B and the Part 3 of Schedule B, which says you are required to file it. And that's also where you say that you've got a foreign trust as well.
Okay. Fantastic. Next one is Peter. I've missed most of this. What email address can I send a specific super question to? On the screen, Peter, we've got both of our email addresses. If you want it on the Australian side, info@atlaswealth.com.au. And on Glenn's side, that's on the screen there, glenn@australianamericantaxservices.com. Sandrine's giving you a smiley face there, Glenn, so I think yeah, she'll be giving you a call to sort that out. And a question from Nicole, is there a limit to how far back you can file a tax amendment, e.g. more than 2 years since it was filed or no longer valid, etc.?
Good question. 3 years. So if you're not going to get, I've experienced this myself, you're not going to get a refund back off them generally. There is some exceptions, there always is, but generally 3 years from the time that you filed it. So you need to look at that. I think I'm trying to pull it out of my head here, but and so generally that tax year is more like, for instance, April 15th coming up. And so if you're looking at getting a refund for 2015, amending 15, you're out of luck after that.
Yep. Okay. James has come back regarding the question before we had with homestead versus PPR. James, I'll actually throw this question to you. Does it matter if you have a homestead if your Australian PPR is past 6 years rented out? James, obviously she's referring to the main residence exemption there.
Yeah. Yeah, so obviously if you've had a main residence in Australia, you've rented it out past the six-year period, then it's going to start attracting capital gains tax in Australia. Obviously, with the changes coming in with the main residence exemption, we just don't know if the Senate's going to push that through before the closing date. But it does mean that that property back here in Australia that you rented out past 6 years has now got some sort of capital gains tax event tied to it.
And that's actually, I'll throw that question to you, Glenn, because I don't think we've even stuck in the Senate. You know, just to explain to everyone here right now, for those who, everyone's probably heard of the six-year rule, essentially you could be an Australian resident, have your principal place of residence, move to the United States, rent that property out for 6 years, and then if you sold that property within the six-year period, you'd pay no tax to the Australian Tax Office. Under the proposed rules, which we've just got to go on record and say it's the most draconian and punitive piece of legislation I've ever seen in my life, if this legislation passes, then you could be living in Australia for 20 years, move to the US, in that first year in the US, for whatever reason, you sell the property. You decide Uncle Sam's your man, you want to, you know, make that your home. Glenn, how, obviously the Australian Tax Office will tax you back for 20 years under this new legislation. How does that work in with the US side? You know, does that suddenly become an issue that the ATO deemed you've had this massive gain? Do you have to report that gain to the IRS, and would they hit you again?
Worldwide. And then you hopefully you get to claim some of the capital gain tax credit against your Australian American taxes.
Yep.
You can see with this situation, you're going to see where the Americans will be giving you, potentially the Americans will be giving you an exemption on capital gain and the Australian government won't.
Yeah.
With the, so let me,
James, go.
Well, just thinking on that type of transaction, you also have to factor in the foreign currency side as well when buying that property 20, 30 years ago, don't you?
Right. Well, when you pay off the mortgage, if you've got, you know, say if you, you know, I got an example, you've paid off the mortgage years ago, when you sell the property, there's not going to be, that's not going to be an issue.
Yep.
Because you don't have a mortgage. You're not paying off any debt.
Yep.
So let me throw this question to you, Glenn. Obviously, the DTA, the double taxation, doesn't extend to the state level. We know there's a lot of Aussie expats in California.
Mm-hmm.
Under that scenario, let's throw that out there. So
and California doesn't have foreign tax credits. And one of the other nasty little things California decided to jump on the bandwagon, that form that I mentioned before, the 8938, a couple of years ago, I think it was November of 17 or whatever, California turned around and said, oh, yeah, if the federal government tagged you 10 grand for saying that you owe them, you owe us one too. We want 10 grand as well.
Okay, so if you were fortunate enough to buy a house in Bondi in 1995 for 500 grand, and in 2015 you moved to the United States, so we've got 20 years of PPR difference. Status in Australia, and that property is suddenly worth $2.5 million in Bondi. Now, you moved to the United States in 2015, and you decide, nah, we've got to sell that property. Essentially, you're looking at 24 years of capital gains in Australia with the ATO. The IRS will give you a tax credit for the money you pay the ATO, but if you live in California, they'll sting you, for those 24 years of capital gains.
Yeah, but remember, you'll get, and then remember your California income begin most. States begin at your adjusted gross income number, which comes before the foreign tax credit kicks in. So that would sting nastily. Well, that's happened. I remember a lovely old lady. She fell in love on the internet, had inherited a property back in the early 70s in London, sold it, and happened to close 3 days after she activated that green card. And so 1971 London apartment to 2000 and. Yes. 15, whatever it was. Yeah. The 40. Yeah. All three, well, over 3 days. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much all the questions there. I mean, you know, guys out there in, on the webinar, if you have any further questions, quickly throw them through now. You know, I just want to say, look, we're not trying to scare anyone at all. We're just saying, guys, this is stuff we see on a daily basis. Yeah. You know, it is not a perfect world. It is not a simple world. It is a complicated world, and it's only going to get worse. So compliance has gone from a nice thing to do to a mandatory point of view.
Yeah, the way of hiding, the days of hiding are gone, that's for sure. Yep. There's too much data mismatching and stuff going on. And not just with tax, for all sorts of things. I'll give you a personal example. I'd never needed to...
So I think Glenn's internet's is...
And then when I had both passed, my daughter and I went back to immigration.
Sorry, Glenn, just quickly, you're
to join up our passports.
Sorry, your internet just dropped out. Can you just repeat that scenario?
I said I got tagged, how the Commonwealth Bank sent me a thing, and I'd already given it to them in the past anyway, was leaving Brisbane a few years ago, and my daughter and I both were US and Australian passports. They said, oh, we're joining up all the US Australian passport holders over here.
Mm-hmm.
We're joining up your passports. I said, what for?
And they go, oh, we'll make it faster for you in the future. Within 3 months, I got a letter from the conference, and it can only be from that. So there's that came from that. So that was an Australian bank doing that. But there's no there's so much that the ATO, the IRS, and the ATO could do to tighten things up. And what if you put me in charge, I'd be doing it. You know, why wouldn't you? That's what you're tasked is to do. It's not about scaring people. It's the factual reality that we live in. And it's about being compliant. And so many times, do the right thing, and it will cost you less in the end. It really will.
Fantastic. No, that's great advice. Guys, well, I think we'll wrap it up there. Glenn, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. We are planning to roll these out all through the year. We're going to talk to mortgage brokers who work with expats. We're going to talk to immigration agents who work with expats. Yeah, I've got on the screen there our social media handles. The best way to keep track of what we're rolling out and what we're doing, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You know, the big thing, the great thing for that is we can get information out there very quickly. And, you know, to us, you know, that's a way to educate, educate, educate. And that's the purpose of this, you know, and as well as the consequent webinar. So, Glenn, thank you so much for your time this evening. And we'll look forward to being in touch shortly.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye-bye. Good night.